Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Art Sear, Scott Hibbard, and Clifford Kelly. Our program tonight coming from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. Tonight, we're going to be talking in the first hour almost exclusively about foreign policy and foreign affairs. In the second hour, we'll continue that discussion, but also look ahead to the State of the Union coming up, and also the issue of gun violence, not only in Chicago, but around the nation. The president will be here later this week. That's one of the topics that he is scheduled to address. And again, we'll talk about that in the second hour of the broadcast this evening. But we begin by talking about foreign policy. I want to start by talking about Syria, because in the armed services hearings that took place this week, Leon Panetta was there, the Joint Chief of Staff, General Dempsey was there. And as part of that questioning by John McCain, it came out that the secretary of that Leon Panetta, in his role as defense secretary, and Hillary Clinton as the Secretary of State, and David Petraeus, who had concocted a plan when he was still at CIA, and the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, they all agreed that the United States should arm the insurgents in Syria. And the president said no. Scott Hibbard, your reaction to that, the dynamic of that? You were stunned by it.
Yeah, no, I was surprised. I was surprised. I know that it was a difficult choice. There was a lot of contention over the relative merits of it. I just was surprised that the National Security Council team was so unanimously supportive of it, and yet was overruled by the president. I'd be interested to know what was happening with the National Security Staff and National Security Advisor. Mm-hmm. So,
Art Sear, your reaction to Scott's reaction and to the basic story?
It shows the president's become a lot more confident in foreign policy in his second term. He spent a great deal.
It was also during a campaign.
He spent a great deal of time, weeks, agonizing over withdrawing forces from Afghanistan. He seems to be much more confident in foreign policy.
Clifford Kelly also joins us, talk show host for WVON Radio.
I'm surprised that the president said no. I'm glad he said no.
Yeah.
I agree with that. Too many times we have supported the wrong group of people. We don't know who we're supporting, and then we give them arms, and they turn out using them on us, which is the same thing that happened in Afghanistan.
But so, in this case, we should mention at least what was stated during the hearings is that General Petraeus, who was then at CIA, and in his conversations with Secretary of State Clinton, that there was a criteria that was set for who would get the arms, that it was not willy-nilly. But again, sometimes they do fall into the wrong
Absolutely.
Hands.
Absolutely, and that's happened before. And that's and, you know,
it happens in this country as well.
that's right. All right. I'll tell you, you know, there are some people, this surprises me even more so, there are some people who have even suggested that the president was given the medal.
Peace pipe?
A little too early because, you know, some of the things that he has authorized that I totally disagree with.
Now, I asked the question, Scott, I want to get your reaction. I mean, the point is, this, according to the testimony, this was a plan presented to him in the campaign. I mean, did he think politically? I mean, was it the White House political staff that just said, Mr. President, we can't do this now? And certainly, you know, you had the big four lined up in support of one policy, and he turned his back on it.
Well, it's also not altogether clear how hard they pushed on it, because if this was something that they really felt strongly about, you might have seen the president go along with it. Just because they supported the policy didn't necessarily mean that they were pushing hard for it, because, you know, it's kind of like the surge or any number policies that are floated by the president. It's not altogether clear that they're going to work, and so there is some hesitation. Even if people do put forward these proposals, there's some hesitation that this will actually fix the problem you're trying to solve.
But again, I mean, two of those people did leave their office. Now, whether or not they were really going to leave, but I mean,
Well, Hillary Clinton moved out. Petraeus was pushing other things yeah, other than this.
Petraeus was pushed out. What I'm just saying is that, I mean, could this be one of the reasons why Hillary Clinton and Leon Panetta decided to move on from their positions?
I think Secretary of State said all for long before this that she was going to, to leave.
She was stepping down.
Absolutely.
Okay. What do we do if we don't arm the rebels, the insurgents, whatever we want to call them? If we don't do that, what should we do, or should we just sit back and let time fly? Art Sear.
I don't think we should sit back and let time fly, but we have very limited capacity to influence events. We've gotten into serious trouble, as everyone here and people in your audience know, when we felt we could control events too readily or too easily. I think prudence is one of the president's strongest characteristics. I have a lot of personal admiration for John McCain, but I must say his willingness to use force, go to war. He wanted us to use force to help the state of Georgia when the Red Army intervened just a few years ago. That's a recipe for a serious disaster. And I'm very glad that our current president is as prudent as he is.
Scott?
Well, I would agree with you that something more should be done, because one of the criticisms is that the U.S. policy towards Syria is very disengaged. I'm not sure whether or not arming the militants is necessarily the right answer, but more can certainly be done on the humanitarian side.
Such as?
There's this inordinate amount of refugees flowing across the Turkish border.
That's a good point.
We can really commit. I mean, we've made verbal commitments, but we haven't really followed through with them.
But that doesn't stop the killing.
Well, it does. It does help, though, engage the key actors in the region, and it gives us a seat at the table, and that's a first step.
Cliff, how would you get tough there?
I'm not sure. Somebody's got to explain to me how this is a threat to the United States. I'm not sure that anybody has done that. I am also happy that he has not gone into Syria.
So should the United States, as a policy, again, we've always said we enter when our national interests are at stake.
What's our national interest?
What about humanitarian interests?
Well, Scott mentioned that, and I agree with that, but we don't have to send troops in to do that.
But how do we stop the killing?
I'm not sure we can stop the killing. But there's so many of the people that have been driven out are in Syria. I'm sorry, in Turkey, as Scott mentioned.
Jordan.
Yeah, and Jordan. Absolutely. We can help them. But as far as going after Assad and possibly, this is one of the things. If we do it at all, it's probably because Israel has been asking us to do it. But I don't think that I don't see our national interest. I really don't.
Do you see our national interest there?
Sure, we have a national interest, but using military force can be counterproductive. Jordan,
what's our national interest? Sure.
Encourage stability, encourage humanitarian behavior, and if I could make this point, Turkey is, outside of Israel, our only real ally in the region, and they're a good deal easier to deal with than our Israeli friends. From the start, the Obama administration has re-emphasized Turkey after relations were almost completely destroyed by the Bush administration's invasion of Iraq. I think humanitarian aid is extremely important in bolstering a stabilizing influence in the region. And Turkey is emerging as one of the most powerful nations in the Mediterranean.
We do have to pause. 1-800-723-8289 is the telephone number. I want to get your reaction to the decision by the president not to arm the rebels in Syria in opposition to some of his foreign policy leadership and Defense Department as well, and CIA. 1-800-723-8289. We'll talk more about that and elsewhere around the world when we come back to Chicago. From Austin, Texas to Anniston, Alabama, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for joining us from coast to coast and border to border. Let's head to South Elgin, Illinois, where Jim is listening to us on our flagship station, WLS. Go ahead, Jim. Jim, are you there? How about James in Austin, Texas at KLBJ?
Yes, to follow up, to answer your question about why, controlling Assad in the national interest is that it deals a blow to the Iranians, okay? The Iranians, Assad is nothing but a puppet of the Iranians. And so it's very important that Iranians know that we're engaged in that area, and goodness knows they need to be sent a message based on their nuclear ambition. But the real reason I called is because of another revelation that was brought forward during the recent hearings from Leon Panetta and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was that on the evening of the Benghazi attacks, Leon Panetta heard from the president and then never heard from him again. He talked to him and said, go ahead and do what you need to do, and then he was never heard from again. What is anyone going to follow up on that? Are we going to find out what happened with that? Why is the commander-in-chief not engaged in a situation like that and not following up? We have no idea what he was doing or what happened beyond that time when he told Leon Panetta to take care of the problem.
Cliff Kelly.
Yeah, Senator Lindsey Graham has announced that he will block the nominations of both Hagel and
Kerry.
Yeah. Not Kerry.
Kerry's already gone.
Brennan.
Right. Yeah.
Until they find out exactly what the caller is questioning. Mm-hmm. He said we need to know that, so he says he's going to block it.
Should we know that? I mean, would you like to know that? Is that
important?
Well,
what I'd like to know is why we were there anyway. Just another thing. Why are we in Libya?
Okay.
Gaddafi was no longer an enemy. I think it's horrible what happened, but again,
that's not germane to the issue that should be discussed, and that is, I mean, you, in a broader sense, yes.
Yeah.
But in this particular case, as Secretary Clinton said at this particular point, what's the point? Why do we have to know this?
She's right.
I mean, but again, if mistakes are made. Or if a president, granted, he's never going to go to the polls again.
Right.
I mean, if he was disengaged at a point like this, should the American people know it, or don't you think the American people care about it? And as a professor, do you want to know?
Well, yeah, of course. But again, I always kind of wonder what the intent of the question is, right? You know, why do you really want to get this?
Is it because
we want to make foreign policy more effectively, or is it just because you want to score some political points?
Well,
let me come back to the original point the caller makes. I think he raised an important issue. You know, the question of Syria is very much tied up in this regional struggle with Iran over control of the Persian Gulf. And one of the challenges of whether or not to arm the rebels is this question of escalation. And, you know, if we start funneling money into the Syrian opposition, are the Iranians going to be funneling money into the PKK in Turkey? And are we going to go to that next level in this, you know, region-wide conflict? Or are you going to try to rein it in? And these are the questions that a policymaker needs to ask. Are there going to be unintended consequences?
But given what is going on, are we saying tonight that there really isn't much the United States can do to stop despots from around the world from treating their people and killing their people and gassing their people, other than, you know, condemning them in the United Nations and scolding them publicly and imposing sanctions, whatever that means? They don't seem to work very many places. Is there anything else that we can do?
Sure.
That would be in the national interest, in that they would be that maybe the United States would be perceived on the international stage as caring so much about the way in which people are being treated that they, as a great nation, are using their power to make life better for those folks.
Sure.
Is that possible?
Sure.
How did we do it, Scott?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing is you define what your goals are, and then you try to define the means by which you achieve those goals. And, you know, it's not just, you know, military means. You know, you have diplomatic means, you've got humanitarian means, you have military options as well. I think if there is a criticism that I would make with the Bush or Obama administration on Syria, is they haven't been engaged diplomatically. And, you know, there more can be done by working with the players in the region, providing humanitarian assistance. I'm not necessarily sure that, you know, again, going back to this question of arming the military or the opposition, is necessarily the only option, I guess is my point. I mean, there are other ways in which we can be engaged. And the other side of it, too, is there's no shortage of weapons in the region. I mean, the Saudis and the Qataris are pumping weaponry into the rebel hands.
Where does the Soviet Union stand? What role are they playing around the world and specifically in this region? You know, the perception is that their military is greatly diminished. But again, how much power do they really have and influence do they really have in this part of the world with Syria and with other nations in the region?
Not much. Historically, Russia has been anxious to expand influence around their immediate borders, but extremely cautious about using military force overseas, except in the last stages of the Cold War in Africa. We were a lot more adventurous. Sanctions, in fact, have severely damaged the Iranian economy. The currency has collapsed. I think you're right that there aren't many examples historically of sanctions making a vital difference, but there are examples. South Africa is one. We are so enormously powerful today, economically and militarily, that in fact we have tremendous leverage. And I would underscore the points made about humanitarian and diplomatic relief. While Secretary Clinton has been a very public and very vocal Secretary of State, Kerry has been in fact doing an awful lot of the regular work of diplomacy, as I understand it, for Obama. And I'm encouraged by the fact that he's now Secretary of State in terms of actually getting things done as opposed to providing a very positive example, which
but
the where Secretary would you, did and again, concerning
I
our
get,
values.
I want to get everybody's response, and I'm going to start with you, Cliff. Mm-hmm. There are bad actors on the world stage. Sure. Bad actors have been doing bad things for decades. But at this moment in the history of the world and in the United States' role, What line would you draw? What line would you draw? Or basically, can any bad actor do anything they want without the United States using its influence, which may include arming the opposition to that despot, to do something to stop people from murdering their people?
I think what Art just mentioned is a very important thing, notwithstanding the fact that we certainly aren't doing anything with Iran, and we're hoping Israel will not have some preemptive strike, because if they do, everybody's going to say we authorized it, whether we did or not. But as Art mentioned, the UN sanctions have really hurt them. Yeah. They're in bad shape, and I think that has a great impact. If they were going,
who hurt the people?
Iran.
Or hurt the regime?
Well,
I think both.
I think both. You know, you have to get this to the situation where you have to understand that we're supposed to be treating everybody equally. And when folks say we want nuclear power for peaceful means, who are we to say, well, you can't do that, when we support people who we know have nuclear weapons who aren't signatories to the Non-Nuclear Proliferation Treaty? That makes us look like we're not doing the right thing here, and you know what I'm talking about. So I think what both of the gentlemen here have mentioned, the humanitarian issue and also the sanctions, and through the UN.
What I'm hearing everybody say is that the humanitarian role is that we take care of the people who have fled a country in fear, gone into another sovereign country, and we want to clothe them and feed them while their neighbors and their friends and their relatives are back in the homeland being slaughtered by a butcher.
Now, I'm saying the UN should be doing that. You know, it's no different than we talked about this a little earlier before the program started, but with the Vietnam War, Art and I were talking about this book, Kill Anything That Moves. This country does not look real well based on some of the things we've done. This is a new book out showing just what we did to Vietnamese people that was just horrific things that you wouldn't even want to believe that we were able to do, that we did do. So all I'm saying is I think we ought to stay out of killing people if we can, based on the fact that we have a lot of problems right here in this country economically, that we can be doing a lot of other things. Now,
I guess the point I'm trying to get to is that sometimes you've got to kill the bad guys, unfortunately.
What's our interest?
But here's my point. You've got to kill the bad guys, maybe to protect more of the good guys. And that's what I'm saying is there a way in which the United States could be perceived, again, as a savior of some of these people? They certainly aren't in many parts of the world. They're still viewed as you know, there's a positive side. It isn't. I mean, you're making a case or painting a picture that every U.S. intervention, you know, that we've engaged, even military intervention, that everybody hates us for that.
Why do they call World War II the last good war? You know, that was a war that we should have been in, and that's why they say the last good war. But there's been a lot of incursions military since then.
Yeah.
Listen, just before the situation, what they just showed Kerry when he was testifying before the Armed Services Committee with his uniform on, talking about the fact we shouldn't be in Vietnam.
Vietnam.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. The Foreign Relations Committee currently.
Yes, right. But I like that thinking. This is what I'm saying. Everybody ready to go to war. No, we don't need it. Well, listen, are you talking about helping?
I want to answer your question, though. I mean, yeah, of course. I mean, there is a time when America doesn't need to intervene in crises. And the question is, in what instances does an intervention happen, and when does that kind of intervention make things worse, not better? And you know, the Syria case is a very difficult one. And unfortunately, it's happening in the context where America is trying to disengage from the region, not, you know, increase its engagement.
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8029. When we come back, we're going to talk about Al-Qaeda in North Africa. We're also going to be talking about Chuck Hagel. Is he the right guy to be heading the Defense Department at a time when budgets are going to be cut? Bruce Dumont back live in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us this evening. Around the table tonight, Scott Hibbert is here. He is a professor of political science at DePaul University. He's been there for a number of years. Also joining us is Art Sear. He is the A.W. Clawson Professor at the Clawson Center at Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin, longtime guest on this program. Clifford Kelly also joins us. He is now a veteran talk show host, former member of the Chicago City Council, and was a frequent guest when this program first started way back in 1980. Hard to believe, 1980.
Awesome. Wow.
Frequent guest, and you look exactly the same.
Thank you.
So do you, Bruce.
Your barber is doing a wonderful job. By the way, let me remind everyone that for those within the Chicagoland listening and viewing audience, that the Museum of Broadcast Communications continues with our exhibition on Harold Washington on the Air, a 30th anniversary retrospective of Chicago's first black mayor. Again, it will be free Tuesday through Saturday from 10 in the morning till 5 at night through February 28th. And this past week, we had a wonderful seminar, which Clifford Kelly participated in. And I can tell people that missed that. Again, it was meant to be a two-hour discussion of the Washington administration, and the conversation just kept going and going. It ended up to be 3 hours. And again, I can tell you that in a couple of weeks, I'll be able to give you the specifics next week. We are going to live stream that discussion on the internet. And I can tell you that it's been 30 years since that group got together and talked about Harold Washington. I think everyone felt that the statute of limitations, if there was, ran out, because everybody was spilling the beans. They were saying things that were rather dramatic and newsworthy, and the news media hasn't picked up on it yet. But again, when we play this, it's pretty revealing. And again, we hope that I will alert you next Sunday night exactly when you'll be able to live video stream and take a look at that. And also, for those within the sound of my voice, Tuesday night, of course, is the State of the Union address. WLS Radio will be carrying it, as well as other stations. But immediately after the speech, I will be anchoring a reaction, instant reaction. So as soon as the speech is over, tune in to WLS 890 AM, and you can call in with your reaction to the president's address. That's Tuesday night on WLS 890 AM. Or if you're listening to us on the stream, you can call in and share your thoughts on the president's remarks. Art Sear, let me go back to you.
May I say one thing,
go ahead.
Please? I just want to tell you, my listeners told me to make sure to thank you, because a number of them have been here. Mm-hmm. To see the Washington thing. So I'm passing that on.
Terrific. Well,
yeah.
I appreciate
that. Great job you're doing.
Let us now, before the break, I talked about, you know, we've been talking about the United States role and when we become involved. And I think there's not been an agreement exactly how we draw that line. But again, someone's going to be the leader, and that is likely to be Chuck Hagel. He is likely to get the votes. But are you confident, Art Sear, that at this particular moment, when cutting the budget of the Defense Department is going to be an important role for whoever the Defense Department secretary is, are you confident that Chuck Hagel has the intellect and the ability and the acumen to do that and lead the country without losing a step militarily?
Yes, I'm biased. I'm a great admirer of Chuck Hagel's. I did have the honor of being around him once at an annual conference at the Council on Foreign Relations. I was very impressed by his intellect and demeanor. As mentioned, he is an actual combat veteran. He volunteered, as did Kerry, for dangerous missions. He served as an enlisted man.
Did you like his testimony at the hearings?
I didn't think it was particularly impressive, but that's not at all directly related to good management and management effectiveness. Robert McNamara, for a period of years, we're talking about Vietnam, would dominate hearings as he tried to dominate everything very effectively. It's no Hagel has actually built a business successfully, as far as I know, before he ran for public office. He's also head of the USO, directly related. He has the faith and confidence, I assume, of serving military people, especially in enlisted ranks. And they're going to be inevitably hit hard, given the tremendous conflict of interest between what we call the military-industrial complex and actual military people. I think he's in a good position.
Scott, yeah. There are commercials running around the country.
Yes.
Reminding everyone what a horrible defense secretary Chuck Hagel would be in the view. Your reaction to the campaign before the votes are cast.
Yeah, that campaign is really interesting because it is new. I mean, it's a campaign-style, you know, attack ads running against a nominee. We have not seen it before, and it's a reflection of the more loose laws that are attending the Supreme Court decision on that. I personally think he'd be a great Secretary of Defense. I don't agree with him on a lot of issues, but I always had a lot of respect for him because I didn't see him as an ideologue. I saw him as very much of a pragmatic thinker. And, you could disagree with him, but you didn't get the sense that he was, you know, ideologically out of tune with people. And
what about the knowledge of the budget related issues that he has to deal with?
Well, you know, he served on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He served on the Intel Committee. I mean, he has a long experience on Capitol Hill. I worked on defense appropriations for a while when I was working in Congress, or I was working as a staff member for a member of Congress. And, it's pretty straightforward. There's a lot of money flowing through the pipeline. And I'd go back to Art's last point. There will be a drawdown of funding. And the big clash is going to be between the big projects coming down the pipeline, the next generation fighters, the next generation destroyers, whatever, and money for people on the ground. And I think because he did serve as an enlisted man, he's going to have a little more commitment to protecting the people that are in the army.
And he actually knows what he's talking about.
Well, exactly.
Yeah. He does.
So I think that would bring a healthy perspective to these upcoming debates.
Cliff Kelly.
I agree with both of these gentlemen. I think he'd be great. I was very happy when the president made that appointment.
It shows some courage.
It does. It shows some courage. And the one thing that he was able to overcome by those...
Where was the courage?
But the president appointing him, because he knew he was going to get a lot of pushback
on
that.
It was a lightning rod.
Wait a minute.
Let me make a comment.
Okay. That is an abuse of the word courage. Because the situation here is you have a president who knows that there are going to be defense cuts. There may be some very unpopular defense cuts. What better person to put in charge of that than a Republican, which they've had Republicans there before. But what better way to put a Republican in charge of it who most Republicans or many Republicans don't like? So he becomes the bad guy. Okay, so that it seems to me that he is not standing up.
I was referring to the Israel lobby. There is
exactly
there,
there that's
are
what I was
issues
going to
and
mention.
Pressures beyond partisanship.
See, Art is saying what I was going to bring up.
Okay,
this is
we'll
what
bring it.
That's why
said,
I said it,
said,
Cliff.
Right?
Yes.
Okay. He said the Jewish lobby, and it has too much influence. Now maybe.
So you think that's the reason?
Some of the senators jumped on Schumer and others. And he talked to them, and they were satisfied. AIPAC there are a lot of Jews who disagree with what they say. So maybe it would have been better if you'd said the Zionist lobby or whatever.
A lot of Israelis disagree with AIPAC as well.
Yeah, exactly.
My point is the president was aware of what Chuck Hagel had said. He was aware that the Israeli lobby or the Jewish lobby, or whoever you want to name them, that there were those that were going to rise up in opposition. My point is, by putting him out there, is he going to be the House Republican who is a lapdog for a Democratic president?
No, I don't think it's going to be that. I think he's going to.
So he's going to stand. He's
going to
stand up for the military.
I think so, and I think maybe if the president did appoint him because of his comments about the quote-unquote Jewish lobby. This is a...
Well, I believe he apologized for that.
But I was going to say, that might have been sending a notice to Netanyahu for supporting Romney.
Yeah, the other thing I'd add is, I mean, that's only half of it. You know, a lot of the opposition is coming from, you know, the neoconservatives, the Dick Cheneys of the world, Bill Kristol's of the world. And they're less concerned about the stand on Israel. I think they're more concerned about the general tilt of the Obama policy about, you know, disengaging from the world. And they, you know, they've advocated a more muscular foreign policy, and they look at Kerry and they look at Obama and they look at Hagel, and they don't see a team that's going to be willing to flex the muscles in a way that they would prefer. So I think that's where a lot of the opposition is coming from.
I want to come back again to sort of the United States and what our role is and what our responsibility is. And there's now a growing discussion about drones. The president has used drones more than all of the predecessors combined. So my question to you, where do you come down on the morality of a drone strike, Art Sear?
Oh, I think it's essential in warfare, and you anticipated me. I was going to remind us all that the Obama administration, for all the rhetoric about weakness, they've been far more aggressive and, in a way, far more belligerent than the Bush administration in using drones to target and kill individuals, including American citizens, which has led to this false dichotomy between killing Americans and killing other people.
Mm-hmm. But people aren't marching in the streets about them.
In Pakistan,
most people, and a lot of the rest of the world,
you better watch where they march.
In a lot of the rest of the world, it's a major issue, and I'm sure it's helping create Al Qaeda support in Africa among
it
other
is,
places.
Yeah, and the collateral damage.
But it's very good evidence for the defense of the Obama administration concerning use of force.
Let me come back to your original question, though, because it does highlight this larger issue of the role of the U.S. in the world. And, you know, we are seeing a disengagement after, you know, 10 years of war and a, you know, very, you know, assertive engagement in the post-9/11 period. We are seeing a retrenchment. And I actually see the expanded use of drones as part of that. I mean, in that sort of way, you can remove the boots on the ground but still have a presence by, you know, using the drones and other tactics. And I see them as very much intertwined.
You know what the signal that it sends to me, or the image that it conjures up with me with the drones, and I want to get everybody's reaction to it when we come back. To me, it sort of reinforces the policeman of the world role. The policemen of the world. It's like these are the folks that are looking over, and if anybody gets out of hand, boom, they're going to get slapped. And that's the way I see it.
If they're in Al Qaeda now.
Back shortly.
This is the problem.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us. Let's go to Raymond. He's listening to us on WKBN in Youngstown, Ohio. I was in your neck of the woods this past week. Ray, go ahead.
Yeah, how you doing? I got a big question.
Are you the guy in the hot tub?
What's that?
Are you the man in the hot tub that calls?
No. Huh?
Okay, all right, never mind.
But, you know, we lost a lot of our jobs to overseas. So you're talking about us being the policemen of the world. My question is, if we're going to be the policemen of the world, starting with Japan, who's going to pay for that?
Well, I mean, the point is that the taxpayers are going to pay for it, and that's one of the things that's sort of tied into this whole budget discussion is literally the process of sequestering that is going to be coming into vogue by March 1st. And there's going to be automatic cuts in the Defense Department. Does anybody think that we're actually going to get to that particular point?
Let me get to the caller's question, because he does raise an interesting issue, right? We have 470-odd bases around the planet. And we spend about $40 billion a year policing the Persian Gulf. That's a lot of money. I mean, to maintain this presence. And so part of the debate over Hagel and part of the debate over the Obama administration's foreign policy is this question, you know, what should our role in the world be? I don't think we're really engaging that because we're not having that broad brush conversation. Now, getting back to your point specifically about sequestration, I can't imagine that it would happen. They'll find some compromise to stave off the, you know, across the board cuts, but you know, you will see less money for
regarding forces overseas. The caller mentioned Japan. We still have substantial forces there in Korea and in Germany. In 1966, Lyndon Johnson persuaded, browbeat, cajoled threatened our allies as our balance of payments deficit was increasing, and back then we worried a lot about that. They pay for our forces outside of wages, salaries, retirement. And we're like the Roman Empire. We have these occupied territories who pay for our forces. So, in fact, during the height of the Cold War, we could not have brought 300,000 troops back from Germany. It's a false issue that lives forever, that somehow we are sacrificing ourselves by having these countries, having our forces in these countries.
I want to go back to the subject that we were talking about before the break, and that is drones. Mm-hmm. Where do you come down on drones?
I think drones used as long as we can be fairly assured. There's a threat. Obviously, killing American citizens, people get a lot upset about that because based on our Constitution, this certainly isn't the way we're supposed to operate. Okay. But even more so, Bruce, everybody says that they are going to be used, hopefully unarmed drones, will be used in this country.
No, but let's not talk about what if. Let's talk about right now.
Well, I just want to say what happened already. Because I just want to say this because people are taking seriously. The legislature in Virginia has voted to make it a 2-year moratorium before you can use drones in Virginia for police work. So already they're talking about that.
But right now on the world stage, it's the front page of Time magazine this week.
Right.
Drones. Are they an important part of U.S. foreign policy now, and how are they viewed by the rest of the world?
I think they are an important part of foreign policy, and if we can be assured that we're hitting people who intend to do us harm, I think that makes it much better than sending ground troops or whatever else. But again, we have to be extremely careful about who we use them on. But it's not going to help us as far as the feeling of other like Pakistan and other places.
Scott, what about it?
Well, I think the real issue is the legal framework in which they're being used. Because the white paper, the memorandum that was leaked earlier this week,
right?
In my mind, that's just a pretty blatant assertion of executive authority, unchecked executive authority. We don't have a FISA court or any kind of judicial check on this. The relevant oversight committees in Congress have not even seen the original DOJ memo that gives them the legal authority to at least to kill Americans overseas. It's a huge problem, and it's this real slippery slope. I mean, because the drone issue is less important than...
So you are as concerned with drone abuse during the Obama administration or a future Democratic administration...
Yes.
As you would if a Republican was in charge,
yes.
Or would
yes.
you be more upset? Because there would be marches in the streets if we were talking about a Republican administration. We've not had the type of national demonstrations about drones and whether drones are horrible things to do. The American political left has not taken to the streets on that as they would have done under a George Bush.
They were used during the Bush administration, Bruce.
Were.
Not as actively as now.
I'm talking about but the uproar, the marching in the streets. If drones are a bad idea, which many on the political left believe it is, they're not out in the streets talking about it.
No.
Marching about it.
People aren't generally marching in this country. They are in other countries. These are small wars in terms of, I don't want to sound callous or academic, but compared to earlier conflicts of ours, these are not large wars. They're not involving a lot of people. Those who are involved are suffering a lot. The suicide rates of military personnel is something that...
So drones are successful.
Something that a Secretary Hagel is likely to address, as did Secretary Gates.
So drones are okay with you right now?
We shouldn't
worry about... The one worry that we should have, if we have one, would be whether or not the success of drones on foreign soil or use in foreign wars would somehow... The great slope here would be, the slippery slope would be that would be used for law enforcement in the United States.
Or even just the abuse of executive authority assassinating people overseas.
Yeah.
Because in some respects,
that's a constant controversy. Yes.
Sure. I want to explain this conversation as we continue in our next hour. We're going to pick up where this goes off. Let's talk more about where drones could be used if we don't want them. If there's anybody, by the way, listening or watching us tonight, that thinks drones in law enforcement in the United States is a good idea. Let's hear from you. 1-800-723-8289. We're talking about drones. We're talking about U.S. foreign policy. We'll continue our discussion with our guests. For those listening to us on radio, you're watching us on television. See you next week. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight, featuring commentary by Art Sears, Scott Hibbard, and Clifford Kelly. Phone lines remain open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. And remember, if you missed the program, you can find it on the web at beyondthebeltway.com. We archive the shows, and keep them for many months, moons, years, long time, sometimes even years. So hopefully you will tune in there if you miss us each and every Sunday night on America's great radio stations, as well as Sirius and XM satellite radio. We've been talking about foreign policy. The president is going to have his State of the Union address. We'll talk about that in this hour. But again, one aspect sort of buttoning up our discussion of foreign policy and what the United States is involved in. Let's talk briefly about, we were talking about obviously drone attacks, and I'm very interested in whether you feel that there's any morality issues in the use of drones, as some have suggested. But let's talk about what's happening in North Africa. Scott, sort of set the scene for us, paint the picture of what, in your view, is happening in North Africa, what the French are doing, and what we are or are not doing.
Parts of North Africa are perfectly lovely, and I was just in Morocco in December, and it's a great place. What's happening in northern Mali is essentially a regional rebellion against the central government. And the one group that the Tuareg fighters that were trying to overthrow the regime were effective in actually getting some autonomy in that region, but the population up there is so fractious that they were very quickly displaced by a group of Islamists that were receiving money from Libya, or not money, but some of the weaponry coming out of Libya, but also have strong ties to the Islamist groups or the reconstituted Islamic militant groups in Algeria. And that's why they were able to, you know, gain control of northern Mali, and that's what brought the French in. It's important to kind of keep this in perspective. When we talk about Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, what we're really talking about is the leftover Algerian uprising or Algerian militants that were very prevalent in the 1990s and early 2000s.
So how widespread is the threat from Al-Qaeda in that region?
Well, I mean, it's a problem. I wouldn't say that it's that widespread. I mean, again, when we looked at the amount of fighters that were actually under arms that were marauding in northern Mali, we were only talking about 800 or 900 militants with 200 trucks or whatever it was. So that's one of the reasons why the French were pretty able to quickly displace them. But it's a problem. I mean, Algeria has long had an Islamic militant problem. They had 10 years of civil war, upwards of 100,000 people killed. It's a problem.
Art Sear, your view of that same region of the world, what would you add to what Scott just said?
Al-Qaeda has been very active for a very long period of time, going back to the 1990s, and I believe our invasion of Iraq distracted attention from that. I'm very glad that we now have a well-established African command under American leadership and that we're looking at that part of the world, not just Mali and Algeria, but Yemen, Somalia, various parts of Africa, especially the Horn of Africa, for many years have been a scene for Islamic radicalism. It is an international organization. As the 9/11 terrorists reminded us, you don't have to have a lot of people given modern transportation and technology, including explosive technology, to do a lot of damage. I'm very glad we're active there. I think it's also important to keep in mind that the turmoil, the Arab Spring, is really pressure for democracy in countries that not long ago we thought were impossible to become democracies. Some of the really good news of the last week or so that is underreported is Mubarak is getting another trial because judicial authorities in Egypt have determined that he was unfairly prosecuted. His natural rights were violated, and he should be retried. That's incredible progress. They're acting like Americans, the British, other Europeans more recently act, but until recently, that kind of rule of law was totally alien.
Since the
so that's good news.
Since the murder of Osama bin Laden, or the capture, the death, assassination.
I wouldn't call it murder.
Whatever we want to call it, assassination,
death.
Yeah, or execution.
Death, execution.
Not murder.
Execution.
Murder.
Execution.
Fair enough.
I stand by. I stand corrected. The question is, within Al-Qaeda and within that part of the world where there may be many Al-Qaeda sympathizers, Cliff, how did they view that incident? Did they view it, you know, the big bad Satan in the United States is going to find me. If they can find Osama bin Laden, they are not going to let any future attack go undealt with, and as well as all of the other leaders of Al-Qaeda that have been killed directly, you know, by drones, whatever. Or does their passion, does their hatred for the United States continue undaunted, and they could care less whether or not they will someday be the victim of a U.S. Military strike?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I think it's certainly up to the person, because we have people who walk into a place with bombs on. You know, they're not concerned about drones or anything else. They're going to die for their purpose. And that's why we have to be as careful and as vigilant. I think, and we were talking about the president during the first hour. Mm-hmm. It was my understanding that most of his advisors did not want to go along with this attack on bin Laden. At least that's what I was told.
Right.
Yeah,
and
he overruled them. Yeah. Which I thought was a great thing. You think about what would have happened if that had been a failure.
Right.
Oh, my goodness, you know. But I think he did the right thing. I'm glad it was successful. And I think it does certainly put people on notice that perhaps, you know, we better be more careful. They're not going to stop trying to take us down, that's for sure. And I'm sure they hate us even more for that when some of the other things are going on.
Slow them.
Yes, absolutely.
Scott, do you agree with that?
Well, let me
stop them, slow them. What does it do?
Let's kind of keep this in perspective. Al-Qaeda is a very decentralized organization,
right.
And it's almost like a franchise. So you've got Al-Qaeda in Yemen, Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, Al-Qaeda in Saudi Arabia. They're not being run out of, they weren't taking directions from Osama bin Laden when he was alive. I mean, Osama bin Laden was actually very isolated towards the end of his era, or towards the end of his life. And many of these regional offshoots, if you will, they have regional ambitions, right? What is the what do the Islamists in the north of Mali want? They want, you know, regional autonomy. You know, what do the what does Al Qaeda in the Maghreb in Algeria want? Well, they want a Islamic state in Algeria. You know, what do the Yemenis want? Well, you know, something, you know, control in Yemen. So, so it's not necessarily that we're, you know, the great Satan in the same way that that we may have been during the Iranian Revolution or something. So, you know, we have to, as we approach these conflicts, we have to really look at the regions and the regional needs. And this kind of ties into the second point I want to make about this, is that we need to also think about what's the problem we're trying to solve. If you look at the Arab Spring, which we talked about, a lot of that was driven by economic considerations and bad governance and lack of rule of law. And, you know, I think one of the problems that we face as a government or as a foreign policy analyst is, you know, you can kill terrorists or Al-Qaeda operatives till you're blue in the face, and until you deal with these underlying issues, you haven't solved the problem. I think the French are going to face that in Mali.
When we come back, 1-800-723-8029, we will take calls and also expand our discussion and talk about the president's State of the Union address coming up, and also gun violence, not only in Chicago but around the country. The president's coming to his adopted home of Chicago later this week to talk about it after the State of the Union on Tuesday night. Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Nice to have you with us. Let's go to calls right away. because TR is listening to us in DeKalb, Illinois. He wants to broaden the discussion and sort of change gears. But again, you bring up a subject that is obviously near and dear not only to the talk show community, but also it's a hot topic in Congress and also with the President of the United States. Go ahead, TR.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. First show, I just first-time listener, first-time caller.
Very good.
I think the thing that, in this gun debate is that honesty must be honored. And what's happening, in, you think there's 75 million people that own guns. There's 300 million guns floating around. And 99.99999% of those guns are owned by honest, law-abiding, decent people. And that's what I think this president is overlooking in his zeal to have his people run around and basically outlaw so many different kinds of, you know, restrict and regulate and whatnot. And all you're doing is going to be harming honest people. Not one criminal is going to be affected by any regulation that Feinstein or Biden or Andrew, how do I call him, Draco Cuomo,
TR, would you acknowledge? I mean, I would acknowledge that the guns that are out there would be very difficult to you know, to deal with. I understand that. And if another gun was never ever manufactured, we have way too many guns in the United States. But my question to you would be, as a gun owner, as a defender of the Second Amendment, do you believe that there should be universal background checks? Whether it's at a gift, whether it's at a gun show, or you go into to Walmart, should there be universal background checks? What's wrong with that?
I am going to be buying a handgun from a guy that lives in Chicago, and we're going to have to take that gun to a gun store and do the paperwork at the gun store. And I am totally 100% in support of that. So yes, I'm living that as of Wednesday.
Okay, so now my next question to all of my guests. Stay on the line because I want to give you the last word on it. Okay, let's say we had universal background checks on mm-hmm. everyone, okay? All right, so more people will continue to buy guns. Hopefully the background check program will sort out X number, probably not a huge number, but a number of people that don't get their guns. The people who don't get their guns because they may have some mental illness or whatever the case may be, they may have abused their spouse, do those people just go to sleep at night and say, you know what, I'm never going to try to get a gun again? I mean, if they're rejected, aren't they going to
say,
a gun?
If we still have the gun shows going,
yeah,
They will sell guns to anybody. You come in with the money, they'll give you a gun.
What about just sort of the black market? What about if someone really wants to have a gun?
No.
And again, let's say we've done all of the abolition. We've redefined magazines. We've redefined, you know, assault weapons. Mm-hmm. We've got the universal background check. It's all in. All the systems all gone. The person who really wants to do harm with a gun, if they don't have one already,
mm-hmm.
aren't they going to find a way?
Well,
to
the
get
people
a gun?
That are concerned about that are also the ones who are saying you have to have registration on guns as you would your automobile. You know, and when you get it, there's a registration number, and if you sell it to somebody or you lose it or whatever, then you have to report that. If you don't, and your gun is found to have been involved in a crime, and you are the person that's right, you got a problem.
TR, do you like that? You like that law?
I certainly do.
Mm-hmm. Okay, all right. Well, here we go.
That's good.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah.
And the irony is, we had this debate at Christmas Eve dinner with a couple of my cousins up in West Michigan because, you know, we're West Michigan. Likes, you know, there's a lot of NRA supporters up there. And, but you know, there is a middle ground that I think most Americans really buy
sure.
into, and this, you know, background
law abiding citizens should be able to get
Why
guns
not?
If they so, want. I just mentioned earlier about the fact that the sheriff in Milwaukee County, not the mayor of Milwaukee, but the sheriff of Milwaukee County said everybody, law abiding citizens, should have a gun to protect yourself until we can come there to help you. Police aren't going to be able to always help you do things.
Do you believe in concealed carry?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But we're the only state that doesn't have it. And
You are not your typical liberal. Although you're a liberal on virtually every other issue when it comes to the Second Amendment, you do not have a liberal political position.
Well, I don't think this is anything. The Second Amendment, even Scalia in one of his writings said, you know, the Second Amendment, which he totally believes in, does not include T-34 tanks and mortars and so forth and so on. Mm-hmm. You know, and it does. I mean, as far as people owning, responsible individuals owning a handgun or, you know, assault weapons are a different issue. A lot of people get confused with what, you know, machine guns have been outlawed a long time. Assault weapons, you can hold a trigger down and just get, you don't get continuous mm-hmm. firing. So I don't have a problem with that either.
Let's head west to Boise, Idaho. Bob is listening to us on KBOI. Go ahead. The voice of Boise. Go ahead.
Hey, all of the regulations you're talking about are already obsolete. You can go online, get the 3D drawings for magazines and guns, and produce them right now in your home. So what you're talking about is already obsolete.
Well, I would say the way you would handle that is the fact, again, what they're talking about in New York, why they have a much, although they're three times larger, they have a lower murder rate with guns than we do, is because when you are found to have a gun that is not registered, you do long period of time in prison. And I think that works. It works.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
Right. I agree.
That's great. Mm-hmm. But the idea that you can outlaw a magazine or a type of weapon and quit manufacturing it, somebody that wants to get that gun is going to get that gun or that magazine, and they're going to be able to do it.
Is there, in your view, Bob, let me ask you this. I want to switch from the gun slice of this debate to the mental health. And I'm going to let you start this part of the discussion, Bob. Where would you draw the line about mental illness? How would we define and how would we keep the mentally ill or the criminally insane from getting a gun? Because they have that same desire? Aren't they going to find a gun if they want a gun, even if they've been deemed as they're mentally ill?
First off, you have to change the privacy laws on mental health professionals being able to release that information. And
I think liberals
and the liberals in America don't want that.
Well, I think, you know, I don't know whether I would call myself a liberal or not, but I would say that I'm not so sure I would like that information released either. So I'm wondering whether this is another one of these issues that, you know, whereas common sense would dictate a certain thing, the reality is that it's not going to solve anything. And I have been the biggest proponent that, again, we've got to do something about mental health. But again, to do something meaningfully about mental health, as you're right, it deals with confidentiality issues, and it deals with insurance as to whether or not people will be covered if they're seeking help from a psychological counselor. Most of that isn't covered for people mm-hmm. that don't have some financial wealth. They have no place to go.
Bruce, the county sheriff here, the Honorable Tom Dart, who I think does a great job, has said that he runs the largest mental health institution in the state, the Cook County Jail. The recognition that so many of those people there have mental problems, mm-hmm. and it's an unfortunate thing, but we got to address it somehow.
But the way we address it is we have to spend more money on it. I mean, because the point is, you can spend money on it at that particular point. You can spend it money on it at in the prisons, or you can spend money up front in the public school system so that there's a way in which that students are tested, and those that are prone to walk down a path that may lead to antisocial behavior, and we'd have to define what that is, mm-hmm. they have to be somehow identified at the front end of life.
Before
I don't know whether anybody's going to do that.
I'm not sure it's possible to do that. It does smack of Big Brother, but I could see all kinds of negative consequences. The problem is it's you can't identify a criminal in advance.
Well, one of evidently,
there's certainly telltale signs. There's
yeah, but that doesn't mean you're
going to
be you're justified in prosecuting and incarcerating.
I don't mean to prosecute. I don't mean to incarcerate. Believe
just
me.
Just mean a scarlet letter You just mean something that will haunt you through. Excuse me.
We incarcerate too many people already in this country. But again, if you are a sex offender in this country, you can go on lifetime supervision after you've paid your dues, after you've served your time.
After you've committed the crime.
After you've committed a crime. That's correct.
Right.
My question is, can that mechanism be used to identify in some way, can identify those that are likely or prone to create and I'm talking about a preventive measure.
Mm-hmm.
Can anybody think of a way to
do
that?
We have the Bill of Rights that stands in the way of
Can we do it with the Bill of Rights? I understand that. Yeah. Can we do it? Or are we just wasting all of this time talking about this issue?
This is not the nature of a free society. I don't want to sound too academic, but, I mean, it sounds very, very ominous to me. And one of the strengths of this country is we don't do that.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
It sounds like the film Minority Report. I don't know if you ever saw that with Tom Cruise. And, you know, kind of the premise is they were catching people before they committed the crime.
Spielberg's.
And, it's actually a very interesting movie, but again, it raises a very difficult issue. Like, is somebody guilty before
and it
they
corrupts
actually,
the basically it's it corrupting does. At the end.
Exactly.
Well, obviously it's a difficult question, but there are other places that are doing it better than we are.
And I want to talk about that when we come back. 1-800-723-8289. Or are we just about talk? I mean, we're a talk show. Donation. But what about solutions? Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Clifford Kelly is here. He is a veteran talk show host for WVON Radio in Chicago. Once upon a time, he was an alderman of the city of Chicago. He was also a member of the Constitutional Convention back in 1970 that wrote the Constitution for the Prairie State. Art Sear joins us. He is the A.W. Clausen Professor, and that's at the Clausen Center in Kenosha, Wisconsin, Carthage College, where there will be a new president that will be soon inaugurated, and there'll be a coronation.
He's already on the job. Greg Woodward, yes.
Greg Woodward.
Yeah.
Were you there?
There's going to be a ceremony in the latter part of April.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Yeah.
I was invited to the inauguration.
That's the Carthage machine in action,
what
Bruce.
They call it? The convocation, what do they call it?
I believe he's being inaugurated.
Inaugurated, okay.
Yeah.
Also,
he's been very much on the scene. Thank you very much for mentioning our college.
Scott Hibbert also joins us. He is a professor of political science at DePaul University. How many years at DePaul?
7 years now.
Hails from Grand Rapids, Michigan, and always great to have them all with us tonight. We have touched a nerve. International relations didn't move the needle. But when you talk about mental illness and when you talk about guns, the phones, they do ring. Let's go to Charles in South Holland, listening to us on our flagship station, WLS Radio. Charles, go ahead.
I think there's a lot of misinformation. When you buy a gun, and even at the gun shows, any federal firearms dealer required to fill out a 4473.
What does that mean?
I was surprised at the new thing on there, and it goes down and they have one thing. Are you buying this gun for your own use? And if you say no, then it can be denied. Everyone must submit to a NCIC check. I don't think this universal check is really makes much difference, but the NCIC. And these checks are only as good as the agencies that respond and put information in. And as far as the mental illness, they don't have to say, all they have to do is put a flag on there that says, no, you cannot do it. They can appear to whatever, a board or something, and then they could decide whether or not they'd be eligible. It would be up to the board to hear their appeal in that. If they think that they're not mentally capable, then they could deny it.
You know, I appreciate that. And Jeannie, let's go to Jeannie in Austin, Texas, listening to us on KLBJ. You want to weigh in on the mental illness aspect of this.
Yes. Hi, guys. Thanks for having the show. I'm letting us have an opinion about things.
Great.
You know, when I was listening a while ago, I was baking banana bread, waiting to get on, and it gave me chills when you said that we should somehow track, or, you know, maybe in the future track people who, maybe it's the kid in the back of the room that's introverted, that's a little weird, that wears all black, that everyone's afraid of. You know what? Here's what I think we should be doing. We should why aren't we tracking these drug companies and all the effects of these, you know, that the chemicals in there are causing people, like when they actually get off, how many suicides? I'd like the drug companies to be tracked and us get a report as citizens of the United States, how many people are dying? How many kids in foster care are on these drugs? How young, what's the youngest age they're putting people on these drugs? And you know, that's all connected to the mental illness discussion, and it just bothers me that it's all about, oh, to track people, when anyone, you know, I'm a musician. I'm very different. I'm very, you know, I have a loud personality and things, and I just say when I was younger, though, I probably was a complete weirdo to some people. I am still a weirdo, but you know what? I'm artistic. I sing and write music. I'm a blues singer. And I'm sorry, as a 49-year-old Mexican woman, I here born and raised in Texas, I don't feel that, I distrust this government a lot more now in my age than I did when I was younger.
Jeannie, let me just ask, you make some very, very strong cases. And again, as someone who has spoken, you know, for years about the need for greater mental health intervention. And maybe it isn't part of this tracking program. Maybe that, you know, is far more draconian, and you know, if people it's something that's never going to happen. So we shouldn't probably spend too much time talking about it. But realistically, I think we could probably agree with your background, with my background, with the background of everyone that's around the table right now, and add 15 more people to this list. I think we could probably, if someone walked in and sat down and talked with us for a while, we could probably make an assessment as to whether or not that person, and let's say it's a child. Let's say we are all teachers. I think a teacher might likely know which students act strangely, and strangely is a hard word to define, act strangely in class, know a little bit about maybe their family background, may know that their actions in class, there's something that's there that they would like that person to have help. Because if that person doesn't get help, maybe they're the next person at the Aurora Theater in Aurora, Colorado.
And I understand that, but how old was that gentleman that did that?
He was older.
Right, and you know, I could see... You know, are you going to start?
But there were probably stops. But there were probably stops along the way, Jeannie, where someone should have and could have identified that person might act out in a very antisocial way.
And it seems like in all these cases, it's been family that has the buck stopped with them, and like denial. I don't even get this. I'm sorry. I have family members that are pretty questionable. I have an uncle that's, you know, I'm not embarrassed to say this nationally. He is serving time for, you know, killing someone, and we all knew that was, we just knew it was coming. I'm sorry. And, you know, when the family tried to raise money to get him out, I was like, I'm not going to put money toward a lawyer. He did the crime he has to serve.
But here's the point. You have just hit the nail on the head, because the frustration that you're talking about is the frustration that I talk about in the wake of all of these shootings. And that is, there are parents out there, good parents. They try to be good parents. Maybe there's two parent families. Maybe it's a mother. Maybe it's a father. Whatever the case may be, and they aren't just exclusively in the poor urban areas of America. I don't mean that just they're not just poor blacks. They're poor whites. They're poor people. But they're desperate that if they see something as a parent, that they see something in their children, and they don't have the money to go and seek help for that child. They are literally. They are trapped in their own lives. And what I would like government to do, when I say government, I would like some entity of government to be there to provide help to those desperate parents that are trying to save their children before they either walk down a road and become drug addicts, before they commit suicide. If they're bipolar, they've got to get the medication. Again, I agree with you about the drug companies. They've got to get the medication. But for
I agree with everything you just said. This goes back to the beginning of your whole conversation when the show first started about budget, and that's what I was actually calling for, because I feel that I don't want any more money put into our government budget at all. I feel like I don't fear the terrorists. I don't know who the guests there are. I kind of, you know, I got in the very beginning. I didn't hear the background. But you know what? As a 49-year-old Mexican woman born and raised in Texas, I'm letting you know that I fear this government right now. I fear all these things going on. You know, drones? Are you kidding me?
I just want to say to the caller, this is Cliff, that you're absolutely right.
Hi,
how you doing, dear?
I'm good.
Good. And I like music, too. Okay.
Thank you.
We just, and the folks here at the table would know this, we just had a budget cut here in Chicago where they reduced the number of mental health clinics by half.
Okay.
Cut by half. You know who called me the most and complained about it?
Who?
Police. The police.
Oh, absolutely.
Because they don't. They want these people to get the medication.
Right.
These folks are being helped. They don't pay, but then they've been cut back. And she's absolutely right.
Cliff, how schizophrenic are we when, again, we're putting all this money into this fear base? There's terrorists. I don't fear any terrorists. I fear what's going on right now, the distrust. No one's been held accountable 4 years ago what happened with the crash of the housing market. And you know, back then, my family was in a financial situation from a 1 to 5. We were a 0. Mm-hmm. We're now a 1. And I have hope. I'm baking banana bread right now, raise money for my album. You know, this is why I think people...
Oh, it's straight banana bread, right?
No, it's
you
not.
You sure? Oh, it's not.
Walnut.
Okay, so you've got a little, extra ingredient in there for your banana bread?
Absolutely not.
Well, I'm just checking because you know you are calling from Austin and you are a musician.
Absolutely, yeah, I get it.
She's all right. She's
guys, good. Thank you so much for giving me the time.
Thanks.
And,
great.
Keep doing what you're doing. I mean, I'm listening, and a lot of people are. So
good, terrific. I hope so. Thanks very much. Always great to hear from Austin. Let's go to WoWo in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Fred, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Sir. Yes, sir. In relation to what I believe Cliff just said,
yep.
Might have been made a misstatement of fact. He has a rather deep voice, so I might have misheard. But he, if I will paraphrase him, said you could walk into any gun show with enough money and walk out with a gun. Not correct. Not even close. All those dealers in there are federally licensed. They're not going to risk their livelihood by doing that, and a gun show would be the last place in the world I expect that they would do that. Around these parts, once in a blue moon, you hear about a firearms dealer that has a shot getting in trouble with the ATF, getting his license jerked, etc. You must have an awful lot of money burning a hole in your pocket if you think you're really going to walk in there and tempt somebody with a fistful of, I don't know what, $1,000 mm-hmm. worth of bills for some gun that costs $200 or whatever. It's not going to happen at a gun show. Now, between two private individuals, that might be different, okay? Mm-hmm. But I don't see much private individual bickering going on at the few gun shows I've been to.
You can have all the regulations you want. A person that wants a gun is going to get a gun. A person who is set out to walking into a school and killing people, unfortunately, is going to be able to do it. That's unfortunate. Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us. Let's go to Dean listening to us on WLS Radio in Chicago. And a reminder, hopefully Dean and everyone within the sound of my voice on our flagship station, WLS Radio, this Tuesday night, the president is going to have his annual, not his annual, his, I guess it's his annual,
no,
his
State
annual
of
State of the Union address, and it will be carried live on all the major radio stations and television stations, but as soon as that speech is over, wherever you are listening or watching to us, switch over to WLS 890 AM because yours truly will be anchoring instant reaction from the voters and America to that speech. So listen to WLS Radio immediately following the president's speech, and yours truly will be leading the national discussion of the president's address. Let's go to Dave listening to us, Dean rather, listening to us in Chicago on that aforementioned station. Go ahead.
Good evening, Bruce. Great show. Just to follow up on the caller from Texas and tracking the drug companies, there have been literally dozens of these mass shootings where the shooters have been on drugs like Prozac, Valium, Zoloft, And there have been numerous lawsuits that have been filed against these drug companies, which apparently are being settled very quietly. And the public is really not aware of the impact that these drugs are having. And this is an extremely common phenomenon with all these mass shootings.
Well, Dean, let me challenge at least the last part of what you're saying, and that is extremely common. Would you acknowledge, and by the way, I will acknowledge that in, let's say, the last 10 shootings of this nature, and I'm talking about school shootings or mass shootings in any way where more than 5 people have been killed, you are probably correct that there has been some cases of pharmaceutical involvement in what might have prompted the shooter to do what they did. I'll acknowledge that if you will acknowledge that there may be 10, 100, 1,000 times more cases that are perhaps stopped because someone is taking the right meds and not forgetting to take their meds.
Oh, sure. I don't have any problem with that. But what I'm saying is that this is a factor, and it's probably a major factor. At least where this manifests itself in these mass shootings, this bubbles up to the surface. I mean, all these drugs have what are called black box warnings on them.
Right.
Where they may say that this could cause severe depression, going off the drug could cause severe depression, may cause suicidal impulses. And now I think one of these drug companies, when they settled the case, had to add that it may cause homicidal urges.
Art Sears got a comment. Stay on the line, Dean.
Sure.
I'm very glad this caller phrased his question and his comment the way he did. We live in a pervasive drug culture in this country in which extensive drug taking has become normal of all kinds. When I was first at Carthage College at the end of the 90s and had a little more time, I participated in a mentoring program that's run in the community, Boys Without Fathers, Girls Without Mothers, male and female people after being vetted. I enjoyed it very much. It was very satisfying. One of the most challenging boys I dealt with was a white boy in a predominantly black school who I'm convinced will either be a significant leader or in the civilian sector productively or very likely go to prison. It was a very intense, positive relationship. When I would go to this school and others, you would see lines of boys lining up for Ritalin. It's handed out like goddamn candy in our school system. It's not discussed at all because we have become so dependent on drugs in this country. When I was talking to this one little boy, a woman who happened to be the school counselor berated him because she knew he wasn't taking his meds. And after she was safely gone from the scene, I'm sure I violated all kinds of protocols by saying, listen, buddy, if you think you can do without this stuff, do without it. I mean, I have very strong feelings on the subject. He's really touched a nerve for me from what I've experienced in my own life and in my own family, as well as seeing in the society at large. And I would urge you to devote more discussion on your program to this vital topic. America is becoming a drug-dependent society. It's enormously destructive. It's very much related to the fact that we look to the school system rather than the mother and the father to take care of these. But yeah, the father, the dad, whatever happened to him? He's disappeared. I mean, there's tremendous demand for male mentors because the father isn't around in these poor areas and increasingly in the suburbs.
But in that case, Art, isn't it always about whether or not the drug was taken? I mean, granted, I mean, there's enough warnings out there about, you know, about the side effects. But again, I mean, are you arguing against that there cannot be a pharmaceutical positive response to, in many cases?
I am arguing against using drugs as the solution to problems. And I agree very much with the point that there are very powerful commercial interests involved in pressing drugs in the civilian sector for all kinds of reasons.
You know, Art makes a great statement, though, relative to I have a saying that the human body is the only complex machine that can be totally reproduced by unskilled labor.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And when you mention the father or the parent or whatever, we've got so many young people who just since the last 25, 30 years, the whole community has changed in certain places where you used to have neighborhoods where everybody would look after each other, and it just doesn't exist anymore. And a lot of the people who come out of that end up, I don't know whether they're drug addicted or not. Some of them are, obviously, but a lot of people just don't know what they're supposed to do.
It also reflects social pressure for conformity in America today.
Yeah.
The one thing that amazes me, that with all the guns we have in this country, with all the pharmaceuticals, with all the, frankly, irresponsible people, and you can define irresponsible however you want, it amazes me that we do not have more of these tragic outbursts than we do. They shock us 4 to 6 times a year in this country. I wish it would go away, but I'm surprised that we don't have it more often. On that disappointing note, let me thank Art Sear and Scott Hibbert and Clifford Kelly for their joining us this evening on our broadcast. This program's a Gen B production, produced in association with WLS Talk Radio. Our thanks to Tom Veracruz and Dan Dorfman for their assistance in the production of the show. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.